From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what it was like to be one of the disappeared. We talk with Argentine poet and activist Alicia Partnoy about being detained, imprisoned, and tortured by her country's military dictatorship in the 70s. Partnoy's poems were smuggled out of prison and published anonymously. Also, documentary filmmaker and anthropologist David Feingold talks about his latest film, Washington, Peru, We Ain't Winning. The film is about Peru's Maoist guerrilla group, The Shining Path, its connection to the drug trade, and the implications for America's war on drugs. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of writer Mary McCarthy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate investigators have concluded that there's not enough credible evidence to back up allegations that the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign made a deal with Iran to delay the release of U.S. hostages until after the election. The report was issued today by investigators for a Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee after a seven-month probe. The report says there was no deal with Iran, although the Reagan-Bush campaign team came dangerously close to improper interference in U.S. foreign policy through its monitoring of the hostage situation. The subcommittee's ranking Republican, Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont, said the report was completed on October 15th, but there wasn't enough time to review and release it before the presidential election. The Russian government is about to submit START 2 for negotiation. The plan is the framework for deeper cuts in nuclear missiles worked out between Russian President Boris Yeltsin and President Bush last June. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
It was called the disarmament race last spring, and it seemed every week Moscow and Washington were trying to outdo each other in their proposals for further cuts in nuclear weapons. Since then, though, Boris Yeltsin has been accused by conservatives here of selling out Russia's nuclear deterrent to the United States, and at times it has seemed as though the Russian government was having second thoughts. But according to Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who held talks today in the Kremlin with Yeltsin, the Russians will submit a version of the treaty for negotiation within the next 2 to 3 days. Some problems are expected, though. START 2 calls for the destruction of all land-based multiple warhead missiles, but the Russians want to retain the silos they are now housed in. Nunn calls the destruction of the silos essential to any verification of the treaty. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Israeli troops shot and killed a 12-year-old Palestinian boy in the Israeli-occupied West Bank today. The killing follows a weekend of violence in which Israeli troops killed 4 Palestinians. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
According to the Israeli army spokesman, the boy was part of a group of Palestinian youths who threw stones at soldiers on the main road between Jerusalem and the West Bank town of Ramallah. According to the spokesman, the soldiers warned the youths to stop, then fired into the air in warning, and only then fired at the stone throwers. But the boy's relatives dispute this account. They say other youths were throwing stones, but he was on his way to school. They say he was crossing the street when he was shot. Palestinian eyewitnesses said the soldiers were not regular troops, but special undercover troops dressed in civilian clothes. Relatives also said the boy was shot twice, once in the leg and once in the head, and they charged the killing was deliberate. The army had no comment on these accusations, but said they are investigating the incident. Also today, 5 soldiers and 7 Palestinians were injured in clashes in the Gaza Strip. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 4 points today. This is NPR News. Sources in the oil industry in Greece say that the latest United Nations sanctions will cut off a significant flow of fuel to Serbia and Montenegro. The Associated Press quoted Greek sources who say that a lot of the fuel used by the 2 remaining Yugoslav republics has been smuggled from Greece by way of Bulgaria. Under the latest U.S. embargo resolution, Bulgaria has now tightened controls over that traffic. Despite the UN embargo in June, Greek and Bulgarian sources admitted that the fuel business between the 2 countries boomed over the summer, as much of the oil was transshipped to Yugoslavia. The nation's colleges and universities proposed major changes today in the way school teachers are selected and trained. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
College presidents commissioned by the American Association of State Colleges and Universities today recommended that only students with outstanding personal qualities and high academic qualifications be admitted by teachers' colleges. The committee wants tougher admission standards for elementary and secondary school teachers and a stronger background in language arts, math, science, and the humanities. The committee is also calling on teachers' colleges to select a more racially and ethnically diverse group of students, saying that these new standards and qualifications are not an option, but a necessity. The committee, which will continue studying the training of teachers for another year and a half, presented its proposals after studying education degree programs at 35 colleges and universities. Although these recommendations have been made before, college presidents say teachers' colleges have been slow to adapt to the real-world needs of most elementary and secondary schools. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The UN Security Council refused today to lift its economic sanctions against Iraq. The refusal came despite an appeal from Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. Aziz insisted that his country has complied with the terms of the Gulf War ceasefire. The council said that Iraq has not fully disclosed its weapons programs. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Close to 30,000 Argentines disappeared in the late 70s under Argentina's military rule. One of them is going to tell us her story. My guest, Alicia Partnoy, was a student activist when the military came to her home and took her away. She was held in secret detention. The military denied she was a prisoner. That's why she and thousands of others like her were called the disappeared. Many of the disappeared were murdered by the military. Partnoy was tortured, but her life was spared. Several months after her detention, she, quote, reappeared and was held political prisoner for 2.5 more years. Partnoy is a poet, and she was able to write while she was a political prisoner. Some of her poems were smuggled out and published anonymously in human rights journals. Now she lives in exile in the United States and serves on the board of Amnesty International. Her poems are collected in the new book Revenge of the Apple. This is a poem she wrote in exile called Biographical Data.
Biographical data. They booted my homeland out from under me, what they call exile. That is, all of a sudden, the ground was gone and distance lay everywhere before me. But one day, before that happened, they stripped me of my freedom. And then, gasping for air, surrounded by iron bars, I felt a little better than when they grabbed my daughter out of my arms. On that day, everything, the future, was gone. You could say I had too much of my own life. And yet, I still remembered the day the military put my homeland behind bars. On that day, I had too much courage, and the fear was gone. That's where it all began.
Did you regret that you had too much courage?
No, I don't think so. I needed that much courage to really confront what was happening. But I also think the courage did not come only from me. It came from a whole movement of people like me in my country.
But I mean, you know, the courage to resist is what got you arrested, and the whole point of the kind of imprisonment and torture that you endured is to scare people out of resisting.
That is true. That is really true. And that is why I still want to tell the story over and over.
In 1975, Juan Perón died, and his third wife, Isabel, was left in charge. Then there was a military coup in 1976. How was your life changed by that military coup?
Well, after the coup, my friends at the university started to disappear. That meant that they were taken away. They were kept in the secret detention places, tortured, eventually killed. Their bodies were never returned. To attend the university, I had to go through a table where high-ranking officers were there with machine guns and a list of wanted people. They could check my ID against that. And because I was an activist, I didn't know when I was going to be in that list and I was going to turn a disappeared. So I stopped going to school. and I had a child, a year and a half. We lived in terror, waiting for them to come and get us as they were getting my friends.
Well, you were taken away in 1977. Army personnel came to your home. Can you describe what happened?
Yes, they came in January 77, almost a year after the coup. I had been active in the opposition movement. The military came, they knocked at the door. It was noontime. I went to open. My little daughter followed. And when they said that it was the military, I refused to open. I tried to run away. I jumped backyard wall. My little girl was there in the patio, and I heard her crying. But for the following 5 months, I became a disappeared person. The military grabbed me and put me in a truck and took me to the headquarters of the army in my hometown of Bahia Blanca, the city in the south of Argentina. And they took my husband too, and we were disappeared for that for 5 months, and then in prison for 2.5 years without any charges. While we were disappeared, we spent the first 3.5 months in this concentration camp, where almost everybody else was killed. And there, my husband was tortured with electricity. We were tortured all the time. We were blindfolded, forced to remain on mattresses or on the floor with our hands tied for all the time.
During the over 5 months that you were disappeared, no one knew where you were, but of course you knew where you, yeah. where you were. How much of your time was spent thinking about what was going through your husband's mind and your parents' mind as they worried about you?
You know, you try to protect yourself, and there are ways you devise that sometimes you are not aware of until time passes. One of the ways for me was not to think that much about my own suffering or about the suffering of my dear ones. I tried to keep track of what was going on in that place, try to understand how many guards there were there, try to tell one voice from another, try to figure how many people were there who were in that place. And that kept my mind busy enough, because if I thought about the suffering of my parents or my daughter, I could really break down and not recover in those circumstances.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Alicia Partnoy. She was a political prisoner in Argentina, now lives in the United States, and serves on the board of Amnesty International. She has a new collection of poems called Revenge of the Apple. When the military men came to arrest you, and you ran away, and then they got you anyways, did you scream? Did you cry? Did you plead with them? Or were you very stoic about it?
I screamed to the neighbors so they could know that my daughter was left behind and they could try to recover her. It's not a stoicism. It's just that it had happened so many times. We knew that it didn't matter how much you could plead with them, they would still do what they wanted with you.
When you were in the concentration camp that was called the Little School, instead of writing new poems, you tried to remember all your old ones. Why did you do that?
That, in fact, is not in the little school. I spent a 3.5 first months of my captivity. I was blindfolded and with my hands tied, and they couldn't give me any pen or pencil. After that, they moved me to a new location where they gave me a notebook and a pen. And yes, instead of writing new stuff, I just remembered. It took me about more than 12 years to realize that the fact that I had made a list of all the poems I had written since I was 9 until the moment of my detention when I was 21, and I had copied all these poems down, was a way of recovering my own history and recovering myself as a human being. They try to, when they disappear you, they erase you from the face of the earth, from the face of society. You disappear. You don't exist anymore. And they try to convey that to you as well as to the society, to the people who fight for human rights. So by rewriting all my history of poetry, of poems I had written, I recovered my past. It was also going to be really hard to deal with the issues around me at that very moment, which were torture and the death of my closest friends, and also the separation from my kid.
You were tortured while you were in prison. What would you do mentally to resist or to take your mind off the pain?
I must say that, again, you can't compare levels of torture, but I wasn't physically tortured to the degree that other people were. The doctor who was supervising torture wasn't present when I was arrested. There were doctors that made sure you didn't die on the torturer before your time came. So they didn't apply electricity with me. They beat me up and they kicked me and they broke my teeth. But it wasn't, I think that the extreme physical pain that a friend of mine, Veronica De Negri, for instance, a former prisoner from Chile, tells of when she was repeatedly raped and when she was even raped with rats. I mean, that type, or the torture my husband suffered when they applied 220 volts electric prod to the most sensitive parts of his body. Again, I didn't experience that kind of extreme physical suffering. And in those moments, people have to summon up all their energies. I don't know exactly what they do. In my case, it was this feeling that I was not alone, which kept me going through the physical suffering and also the psychological suffering. Well, the starvation, the living in those conditions that were not human. The feeling of not being alone, of not being wrong in what I was pursuing, was what kept me going.
One of the things the guards sometimes did was put a gun to your head and pretend like they were pulling the trigger.
Yes.
What would go through your mind in those moments?
I just tried to detach myself from that at times. At times, black humor helped me a lot, and at times it was so crazy. The situation became so crazy. Like that day they gave us toothbrushes and they forced us to brush our teeth when we were not in contact with water for a long time. And then this guy comes and puts a gun inside my mouth and threatens to kill me or pull the trigger. In that situation, I was really resorting to my sense of humor to survive, thinking this is totally absurd, and that helped me.
Alicia, we have to take a short break here. Why don't we take a break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is poet Alicia Partnoy, and she was a political prisoner in Argentina. She now lives in the United States and serves on Amnesty International. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. poet Alicia Partnoy is my guest, and her new collection of poems is called Revenge of the Apple. You were disappeared for the first part of your imprisonment, so nobody knew where you were. Then your family was notified, and you became a political prisoner, and they could actually come visit you. When you were disappeared, did your parents try to find you?
They did. They did, like the parents of so many of us. But they were shown a piece of paper allegedly signed by me saying that I had been released.
Oh. Did you sign that? Or
no, I didn't.
Did they believe it?
No. No, they did not believe it. And they tried. I mean, they kept looking for us.
Your father is a university professor. Did your parents support your activism when you were a student?
My parents were very scared of my activism after the military coup, and they did not share my political views before the military coup happened. But they understood that this coup was beyond any democratic effort. This coup was totally out of place in a society that had to live under democracy.
What was the occasion for your release?
I came to this country as a refugee by the end of 79. There was a decree where you could apply to the right of option. That meant option to stay in jail or be expelled from the country. I applied to that, and I got a visa to come to the United States as a refugee. It was under the Carter administration and the human rights policy of President Carter towards Argentina was very strong. The Organization of American States was also visiting the country and monitoring on human rights. So the combination of both things produced a release of some prisoners. I was one of the very lucky ones.
Did you take your daughter with you?
Yes, I took my daughter, and we both came to the States. Also, my husband was released, and he also came to the United States.
You have a poem about being a survivor, and in it you write that you carry your rage like a stinking fish. People on the streets flee from you. Do you feel still that people sense what you've been through and it frightens them?
Very few times, yes, I do. That's one of my very bitter poems. I usually do write more about the strength that I find in others to survive. People try to understand, and in the process of trying to understand, especially in this country where these experiences seem to be so remote, in this process of trying to understand, sometimes one of the most dangerous things that they do is try to see me as a very special person, a very different person, some kind of maybe a hero or a freak, and that's what I'm trying to fight against. If you see as survivors, as heroes, because we speak out, then it means that the rest of the people are allowed or somehow are free not to get committed, not to do something to stop injustice.
Because it means you have to be a special kind of person.
Yeah, that's right. That's the danger.
Can I ask you what it was like when your family was reunited after you and your husband were released from separate prisons and were reunited with your daughter? I mean, the three of you had been separated for years. You and your husband both suffered through separate imprisonments, and I imagine people are changed very much by that experience. So is it hard to become a family again after going through that?
Yes, it was so hard that we separated with my husband. We divorced after that. We couldn't really, we didn't have the energy to keep going as a family. And it was a time of much joy because we were free and because we got so much support. We were in Seattle, Washington. The churches There were several churches that were supporting us and supporting refugee programs there. And we got so much solidarity that helped us heal. But on the other hand, it was a time of much confusion. And I think we are still, especially my daughter is still suffering the consequences of that exile.
Let me ask you to leave us with a poem. Would you read your poem, Testimony, for us?
Testimony. This microphone, with its cable coiling around it, bows to me. I woke up to it, opened my eyes, opened my book, opened my mouth. That's right. I open my mouth wide and begin my story. They say I speak too softly, that I'm practically mumbling, that they can't hear the screams piercing. I open my memory like a rotten cantaloupe. They say I have not managed to forcefully convey the pitiless rage of the cattle prod. They say that in matters such as this, nothing must be left open to the imagination or to doubt. I take out the amnesty report and begin speaking through that ink. I urge, read. I, in my turn, coil around. My bowing accomplice, this microphone. I urge action as a prescription, information as an infallible antidote. And once every knot is untied, I recite my verses. I resist. I am whole.
Alicia, do you ever resent it when people say, tell us your story, tell, you know, we want to hear all the drama of it?
It depends. Yes, in many cases they do it out of some sensationalism. In many cases, journalists want a very even titillating story. At times I can sense that in people. When people do it for the sake of information and future action, I just don't mind. It does hurt me to remember. It does. It does help me to remember in English. It shields me. If I had to tell this in Spanish, I could cry more and more often. But it serves a purpose. It serves a purpose, and I'm very willing to keep on doing it.
Do you feel that sometimes people want you to tell your story so that they'll feel better about their lives? Well, at least I didn't have to go through that. I guess I'm pretty lucky after all.
It does happen. That indeed happens. And that I write also in the introduction to Revenge of the Apple is that it took me a long time to realize why people could ask for gruesome details of torture and suffering. And it seems that the fact that all those things seem so and so remote sort of protects people. And like you said, they tend to feel safer. Something so horrible will never happen to them.
Alicia Partnoy, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alicia Partnoy's new collection of poems, Revenge of the Apple, is published by Cleus Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, links between Peru's Shining Path gorillas and drug trade in America. Filmmaker and anthropologist David Feingold has been studying the international drug trade since the 60s and has just made a film about the Shining Path, its connection to the Peruvian drug trade, and the implications for America's war on drugs. 60% of the world's cocaine comes from coca leaves grown in Peru. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of writer Mary McCarthy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. This has been cleanup day for hundreds of people whose homes were damaged over the weekend by tornadoes. Twisters struck in 11 states, killing at least 25 people, injuring hundreds of others, and causing millions of dollars in property damage. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports on cleanup efforts in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Two people were killed in Hillsboro, including a two-year-old boy. The worst damage was to a mobile home park, where several trailers were reduced to piles of rubble. Danny McCauley was one of several Hillsboro residents who spent the day sifting through the ruins of his home, trying to salvage anything he could.
We got a few clothes and our deep freezer, say about two TVs. I'm still looking for a motor shoe and my license. Can't find my driving license.
Tornadoes were reported in 16 North Carolina counties, ranging from the mountain region in the west to the coast in the east. Near Elizabeth City, a tornado apparently lifted up a loaded school bus and pitched it into a field. Several children on the bus were hospitalized. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Once again, UN aid flights to the capital of Bosnia have been suspended because of heavy fighting around Sarajevo. Officials say that flights will continue tomorrow if the firing dies down. Two more flights had been slated this afternoon, but it was felt that landing at the capital's airport was too dangerous because of the continued fighting. Officials say that while there are heavy artillery battles around the airport at Sarajevo, the airport itself has not been attacked. On Capitol Hill, a Senate subcommittee investigating allegations of a so-called October surprise says that it can find no credible evidence that the 1980 Reagan campaign tried to delay the release of 52 Americans held hostage in Iran. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Ever since the 1980 election, there have been reports that the Reagan campaign cut a deal with Iran, asking it to delay the release of the hostages it held till after the election in exchange for future U.S. arms sales. Last year, a former Carter administration official concluded in a book the charges were true, but the investigation by the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee found otherwise. Washington attorney Reid Weingarten led the probe.
I was able to put, I think, all the key operatives over whom I had jurisdiction under oath. And I was able to get within the bowels of the executive branch agencies and look at the relevant evidence.
Weingarten says Reagan campaign chief William Casey was intensely interested in the hostage issue and conducted potentially dangerous efforts to gather intelligence about it. But there's no evidence he sought to delay the Americans' return. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 4 points to close at 3,223.04 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Three U.S. senators just back from a visit to the Far East say that Vietnam should benefit for its help in looking for missing U.S. servicemen but not be granted full diplomatic relations. The 10-day mission turned up no new evidence that Americans may still be alive in Vietnam, but according to the senators, it did open up the possibility of more cooperation between the two nations. Senator John Kerry said the president of Vietnam asked the senators to take a letter to President Bush about the missing in action question and its connection to better relations between the two countries. Kerry said he would advise the president and the incoming Clinton administration to take steps to respond to Vietnam's cooperation, but not to give up their bargaining power. Former senator and Democratic presidential candidate Paul Tsongas has been released from a Boston hospital after undergoing tests on a lump in his abdomen. Tsongas retired from the Senate after one term in 1984 when he was diagnosed with a form of lymphoma. David Green of member station WBUR reports.
Doctors say they discovered a growth 3 weeks ago in Paul Tsongas' abdomen. Last week, they performed a surgical biopsy to determine whether it is malignant. Tsongas was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer in 1984. He gave up his seat in the U.S. Senate and then underwent successful bone marrow treatment. During his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination earlier this year, Tsongas' doctors declared him cancer-free, and he filmed television commercials that showed him in good health as a response to questions regarding his condition. Tsongas told reporters from his hometown newspaper in Lowell, Massachusetts, that he expects results of the biopsy soon, and that if the lump is cancerous, his doctors expect to be able to treat it. Tsongas also said his doctors told him the rigors of the presidential campaign had nothing to do with the appearance of the lump. For National Public Radio, this is David Green in Boston.
In trading in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. America hasn't won its war on drugs. David Feingold's movies show some reasons why. Feingold is an anthropologist turned filmmaker who has been studying the international drug trade since the mid-60s. He's made movies about the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, where opium poppies are grown to make heroin. With his partner Shari Robertson, he gained rare access inside Cambodian territory controlled by the Khmer Rouge. For their latest film, they went down to Peru to study the coca economy and its connection to the Maoist guerrilla group known as the Shining Path, or the Sendero Luminoso. Part of the movie takes place in Washington, D.C., as congressional committees debate America's drug policies. That film, Washington, Peru, We Ain't Winning, will be shown on many public TV stations in January. The head of the Shining Path was imprisoned 2 months ago, but many experts agree that doesn't mean the end of the group's violence and power. Yesterday in Peru, elections were held for a new Congress. The elections were called by President Fujimori 7 months after he suspended the Constitution and disbanded Congress. His party is projected to have won a majority of seats. I asked David Feingold how he interprets the election.
The elections in Peru are an attempt by President Fujimori to reestablish the legitimacy of his government. The main opposition parties did not participate. The most recent information is that President Fujimori probably has a majority of 43 seats out of 80. This election was to establish a constituent assembly to rewrite the Constitution. The president has also said that if the Congress doesn't go along with him, he very well might dissolve it again.
So I know there's somebody in your film who says we elect a dictator every 5 years in Peru, and people inside and outside the country confuse that with democracy. Do you agree with that perception?
Essentially, yes. That was Hernando de Soto, who has very clear insights into Peruvian politics. What I think is the important point is that this election does not reestablish democracy in Peru. What it does is create the facade of democracy. Now, there is a possibility that President Fujimori will go ahead and further democratic reforms, but those reforms are not present now.
Let's look at what's happening now in Peru might affect what's happening in the United States, and I think the United States' kind of main interest in Peru has to do with the growing of coca and the amount of cocaine that really originates in Peru. What is the United States up against in Peru?
In Peru, the United States is up against what is essentially a virtually impossible situation. Peru produces 60% of the world's cocaine. In declaring war on drugs, and the United States has declared various wars on drugs, the first one was under Nixon, none of them have been successful. The problem is that it essentially says, all right, we can't solve our problem here at home. So even though our police can't clean up the problem, we're going to expect the Peruvian police, the Colombian police, the Bolivian police, the Thai police to solve our drug problems overseas. It's something that sounds very appealing in Washington. There was a very good example. There was a man who testified before Congress who said, there are only three plants in the world that cause all the drug problems. You get rid of those three plants, coca, opium poppies, and marijuana, and you solve the drug problem. Well, in fact, that's not the case, but more important, you can't get rid of those plants.
Let's look at why. Now, a lot of the Peruvian economy in the countryside has really become built around the drug trafficking.
Well, there's two things. First of all, coca has been essential in Peruvian culture. The first archaeological finds of coca were around 1800 BC. So there is coca that is used for chewing by many of the Indian highland populations. Coca tea is widely served in Peru, and people use it without any ill effects. That's not using cocaine, that's chewing coca leaf. In addition to that, the commercial production of coca for cocaine really has only taken off in the last two decades. And essentially it was when people in the upper Huallaga Valley found that they couldn't grow anything else and get it to market. To understand why coca is so important, you have to understand a couple of things. First of all, you can grow coca on land you can't grow anything else on. Second of all, you can get between 4 and 6 crops a year. What you do is you pull the leaves out. That's the crop of the plant. Thirdly, it's a very hardy plant. In other words, with the exception of a fungus that sometimes attacks it, once the coca plant comes in, you don't have to worry a lot about it. There's also drawbacks to it. Once you grow coca on land, you basically can't grow anything else for 10 years. So
that's a disincentive to change right there.
That's a disincentive to change right there. Now, in addition to that, the drawback of coca is that it comes with violence. On the one hand, the good point from the farmer is the market comes to you. You don't have to worry about carrying your potatoes or whatever it is that you're growing down to the market in town. The guy who's going to buy the coca comes directly to you. The drawback is that that guy is often either a Colombian trafficker or working for a Colombian trafficker, and he says to you as a farmer, we expect you to produce so much coca. If you don't, we're not only going to kill you, we're going to kill your family. Now, what happened was that the Shining Path, and also, to complicate matters, another revolutionary group, the MRTA, came in and said to the farmers, look, we'll protect you against the police, we'll protect you against the army, and we'll bargain with the Colombian traffickers to get a higher price for your crop. In return for this, give us a tax on the crop, 10%. Well, if you can get 25% higher for your crop and get protected, and you have to pay 10%, that's not too bad.
Okay, so we have this system in which you have a whole economy built around growing coca. You've got the Shining Path making its profits off of it, too, and getting a tax in return for protection. Now you have the United States coming in trying to eradicate coca. What has the United States policy been? What has its approach been to trying to eradicate coca in Peru?
The initial approach was to pressure the Peruvian government to cooperate in eradicating coca. This was first done by hand. There were tests of herbicides. These were notoriously unsuccessful. It didn't work. What it did do was allow the Shining Path to become established, and also it spread coca cultivation to new areas. The Americans established a base called Santa Lucia in the upper Huallaga Valley. This is a relatively small base. I believe they have about 10 DEA agents there who are very brave. It's a very, very dangerous area. The problem is they can't solve the problem. Most people don't realize how big the Huallaga Valley is. It's 3 times the size of El Salvador. It is not something that you can go in with a military force and solve the problem. The other thing is there are approximately 1 million people who earn their living from the primary production of coca. If you have 1 million people as your enemy, you're not going to be able to do the job. Essentially, the only possible solution, which is what the Peruvians have been saying, is to be able to undertake economic development in the valley, which will provide the farmers with reasonable alternatives. Those reasonable alternatives do not always have to provide an exact dollar-for-dollar basis for their income. If you can also provide services and, again, protection and order, many of the farmers have said that they would be willing to do something else. The problem is right now, many of the farmers feel they are caught between the guerrillas on the one hand and the army and the police on the other. In the film that Shari Robertson and I did that you've seen, we were up in the mountains and we were speaking to coca farmers. One of the men who was working in the field said to us, we asked him, were you bothered by the police or the army? He said, well, the army comes through. Occasionally they beat up the owner of the field and they take their share and then they leave. So for many of these people, they do not trust the authorities with good reason, and they are victims. And one of the things that was pointed out many years ago in a congressional report, which is still true today, is that the drug trade, whether it's the opium trade or the coca trade, has two sets of victims. It has the farmers at one end, and it has the junkies at the other. And everyone else in the middle is making out like bandits. The bandits make out like bandits. The street dealers make out like bandits. And also the bureaucrats do well, not because they are corrupt for money, but because they get rewarded with higher budgets because there is a problem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Feingold, and he has produced a new movie called Washington, Peru, We Ain't Winning, which is about the United States war on drugs in Peru and the Shining Path's inroads into the drug economy of Peru. And that program will be shown on many PBS stations in January. David Feingold has also done several movies in Cambodia on the drug trade there and on the Khmer Rouge. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is anthropologist David Feingold, who's made many movies on the drug trade in different parts of the world, and his latest film is about the drug trade from Peru. You have compared the Shining Path to the Khmer Rouge in terms of its structure and its guerrilla operating style. You spent a lot of time in Cambodia. You've made several films there, and you filmed the Khmer Rouge. You were actually able to talk with members of the Khmer Rouge, which is a very difficult thing to do. Yet you were telling me before we started this interview that filming in Peru was really more dangerous for you than filming in Cambodia in Khmer Rouge-controlled territory. What was so dangerous about Peru?
Well, I think, let me take the first part of that question of how there are similarities. Both the Khmer Rouge and the Shining Path are Maoist organizations. Interestingly enough, both Guzman and Pol Pot were in China at the same time. In fact, what I'm dying to get is a picture of Pol Pot and Guzman having a drink together in China. So you have a strongly Maoist cultural revolution orientation to both groups. Secondly, you have a small cadre. Don't forget, the Khmer Rouge started off with three guys sitting in the jungle in 1963. You have an emphasis on discipline, and you have an emphasis on political analysis. Both the Khmer Rouge and the Shining Path believe that if your political analysis is correct, then everything else follows from that. What this leads to in the case of the Khmer Rouge is if the world doesn't respond as your analysis says it should, well, there's two possibilities. Your analysis is incorrect, which is not an acceptable point of view, or there are traitors.
And you can kill them.
And you can kill them. And one of the Khmer Rouge slogans was, to keep you is no benefit, to destroy you is no loss. One of the current Khmer Rouge slogans is, we will grind the men for fertilizer and keep the women for reproduction. So what you have is the use of intimidating violence, but even more the use of indoctrination. And the Shining Path takes the point of view that everyone but them has sold out. The Russians sold out, the Chinese sold out, the North Koreans sold out. They sort of think the Khmer Rouge were all right, but they got a bit slack.
Your film is really about why it's so difficult for the United States to be at all effective in Peru in stopping the growth of coca. Do you have any hopes that the United States can control either the drug trade or, you know, the entrance of drugs into the United States, or to control the use of drugs in the United States?
Having worked on this problem for a very long time, I first started to work with opium growers on the Thai-Burma border first in 1964. I'm not at all optimistic. I have seen many wars on drugs. When I first started to look at Burma, Burma never raised more than 400 metric tons of opium. At the end of the United States-supported suppression program in Burma, they raised over 1,600 metric tons of opium. That makes it the most successful agricultural development program undertaken any place in the world. So I'm not particularly optimistic. I think that a sane drug policy means that you have to confront realities, and the realities are this. We cannot solve the drug problem overseas. No matter how many acres we spray with herbicides, no matter how much we try and say we're against drugs and we want every government to be against drugs, we're not going to solve the problem that way. I think that one of the things that I understand the Clinton administration has said it's in favor of is treatment on demand. In other words, the only point of enforcement is to force people into treatment. The worst scandal is if somebody wants to get treated and can't. Secondly, basically prevention is the only thing that will work, but prevention is very difficult. What is more, it is very difficult to measure. And this in bureaucratic terms is extremely difficult. You can't show that a dollar spent on prevention has a dollar's worth of prevention results. That's very difficult. It's very difficult to measure non-events. So that part of confronting the drug problem is to say we cannot have a drug-free society. There is basically no drug-free society in the world. What we can do is try to ameliorate the costs of drugs, to do away with open-air drug markets in neighborhoods, which have a lot of costs for the people in those neighborhoods. Kids get shot. People are afraid, all sorts of things that go with that. We can push education as strongly as possible. We can push treatment as strongly as possible. Now, that's a very pessimistic view. But sometimes I think that you have to take that sort of view before you can start to say, all right, let's look at things we can try and see if we're going to make the situation better, not worse. It's very easy to make it worse.
David Feingold, his latest film, Washington, Peru, We Ain't Winning, will be shown on many public TV stations in January. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll report on the tornadoes of the weekend in the South, including the story of a church in Georgia. The pastor on Sunday decided to have the congregation sing the final verse of Amazing Grace just one more time. The tornado hit while everybody was still safe inside. We'll check in with the Clinton campaign in Georgia. President-elect Bill Clinton this time is trying to help Democratic Senator Weish Fowler in his reelection bid. Also, Senator John Kerry reports on his trip to Vietnam, checking into the accounts of missing Americans in Indochina. And memories of and music by Roy Acuff. He was called the King of Country Music. He died this morning.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The late writer Mary McCarthy's best-known works include The Group, The Company She Keeps, and Memories of a Catholic Girlhood. In the introduction to a new biography of McCarthy, author Carol Brightman says, McCarthy's work is unimaginable without her life, which fed it like a furnace of gods. The biography is titled Writing Dangerously. Critic John Leonard has a review.
Carol Brightman's new book on Mary McCarthy is the best literary biography I've read in years. Compounded in equally stylish parts of investigative reporting, cultural history, political savvy, textual criticism, and wicked gossip. Princess among trolls, Mary McCarthy laughed at herself. Dark age luminary and Irish hothead, said Robert Lowell in a poem. Out of her wretched Dickensian childhood, the Vassar years she used in The Group, the left-wing politics of the 1930s, decades in New York and Paris, and years on the road from Venice to Hanoi, four marriages, and many a friendship of the sort she described as a growth hormone the mind requires as it begins its activity of producing and exchanging ideas, the writer invented herself, Mary, the bad girl, a sort of literary Cher. After memories of a Catholic girlhood, she confided that she was no longer interested in the quest for the self. You won't find it, but it's possible, in some sense, to make it. She didn't mean making a mask, but you finally begin, in some sense, to make and choose the self you want. For someone who wrote such splendid memoirs and couldn't keep herself out of any of her novels, McCarthy was often less than wholly truthful. Brightman tracks her down in letters, interviews, and chats with her subject up to the day before she died in 1989. While not every one of the more than 100 men she claims to have slept with is named, there are surprises, including shipboard advances made by the horny theologian Paul Tillich and a pass by Igor Stravinsky. More scandalous, perhaps, is the news that Mary's best friend, Hannah Arendt, had an affair with the philosopher Martin Heidegger before and after he joined the Nazi Party. Of Mary's marriages, the one to Edmund Wilson is of most compelling interest to literary groupies. He beat up on her and stashed her in a psychiatric hospital, but also made her write fiction. Her biographer thinks she got so much done in this marriage because, quote, it recapitulated the central drama of her childhood with its attendant themes of enslavement and helplessness. As hard as Brightman is on McCarthy's fiction, there was, she says, a hardening of the emotional artery that connects the wounds we sustain and the wounds we inflict to the brain. She is sky-high and persuasive on the memoirs, the theater criticism, and the books on Vietnam and Watergate, those twin adventurisms of a bankrupt culture to which Mary responded with more valor than anybody else in her Partisan Review set. There's a lot on Partisan Review, and The Nation, and The New Republic, and The New Yorker, not to mention the Congress for Cultural Freedom with its CIA front money, and what Brightman calls the sweetheart deal that American intellectuals enjoyed with the dark angel of American government for nearly two decades. There's material as well on Lillian Hellman, Simone de Beauvoir, and Immanuel Kant, on Venetian painting, Florentine sculpture, Gothic cathedrals, and the writer's Job-like afflictions, her cardiac episodes, her torn retina, her breast cancer. Writing dangerously is wonderfully rich, and I'll always think of the heroine at Bard College, where she gave a Russian novel party, and everybody had to come dressed up as their favorite character, and Mary McCarthy was Anna Karenina.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Malcolm X, The Man and the Film. We talk with African-American scholar Gerald Early. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews the new recording of the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.